because I can't have people coming up and stuff like that, so I'm going to have questions tonight. I usually wait till later and have people come up, but we're not going to do that tonight. It won't work. So, are there questions? Okay. I'll start back there. Mister? Sir?
Amen. My question is, what if you really like someone, but you're not sexually physically attracted?
He wants to know.
He wants to know, what if you really like somebody, but you're not sexually attracted to them?
And I'm putting more weight into that. What I mean is that, say that some of my non-emotional services can meet some physically emotional experiences about people, but I'm not physically or sexually attracted.
Right.
Those, they have those.
Uh-huh. Well, there are a couple of things. One is that you'd want to ask yourself, am I experiencing sexual anorexia? Okay? Because if you are, then it's not about what's going on between you and that person. Sometimes, and I know this might shock everyone, sometimes you make friends, you have good friends with somebody that you probably don't need to marry. And it's good to know, though, before you make that choice, whether or not you're in an anorexic position. Because you also don't want your sex addict making your decisions for you about sexual relationships. Because sometimes people say, well, I just don't feel all the feeling. And it's like, well, are you attracted? Well, yeah, I'm attracted, but I just don't feel all the feeling. Well, what I would say to that is that, well, okay, your sex addict is not happy with this. Do you really want your sex addict determining whether or not you're going to be in a relationship? But it's, you know, it's okay to have friendships with people, close friendships with people, and not marry them. Does that make sense? Is there anything?
Just the point we used a second ago, dovetail on that, is that a reason to date them exclusively?
I would date someone exclusively for 90 days. And sometimes, if you're in an anorectic position, things kind of start feeling differently. You know, I was just thinking about a guy way back who said, you know, she's not my type, and, you know, I just don't have that big jolt, and it doesn't seem like there's this energy, but I really like her, we really have a good time. So he started, after about 6 months, he said, you know, I'm really attracted to her sexually, even though all these other things aren't really going on. He said, I really think I know now what that being attracted to someone's inner self is more about. And because he was doing it exactly the way I suggested. I just said, get to know her. Find out the things you don't like. Do the things you enjoy doing with her. And he did. And he still liked it, so he kept doing it anyway. It's like, well, okay, I'll just keep doing it, even though nothing is there. And then he said, now I'm feeling something, and it's not like anything I've ever felt before. I said, probably because your sex addict's not running the show. Because if you're looking for all the big lights and excitement and all that, your sex addict's on board. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I have two questions. One, how did you meet your current partner, i.e. partner of life? And two, whatever happened to that addictive relationship that you were in that one time, how did it end, and where's that person now?
Where's that person? I don't know. I met my partner.
Yep.
Thank you. It's like something about me, right? Anyway, so we met. I've been involved with many elements of the women's movement, and I used to do a lot of domestic partnership work, or domestic violence work, as well as sexual assault and all that back in the early times. And so she is a police officer.
Okay.
I just did it. Too bad. That's out of that.
Whoops.
Okay.
There goes.
I'm in trouble. She happened to be the sergeant in domestic crimes, domestic violence crimes for the Seattle Police Department, and they were having a fundraiser to raise money for the King County Domestic Violence Project. And they were having a long, you know, a weekend long softball tournament. And one of my son's friends, who played soccer together, said, "You should come to this with us and meet some people." Well, I wasn't interested in meeting people, but I wanted to go do my bit because you go pay money to do this, and you know, it's a lot of fun. And James wanted to go because his buddy was going, and so I went and I met her because, of course, she was there. And now the difference was that I decided that I'd been out of a relationship and I liked it. I liked not being in a relationship. And I thought, you know, this works for me. I can have friends, I have friends doing stuff with. It works really well for me. But I decided that if it ever came up again, that I would be making the decisions in my brain, not in my heart. So I wasn't going to, like, do the thing I used to do when my Sex and Love Act was on board, which was, you know, zone in on whoever it was. It was the most closely connected to all of the worst qualities of my parents. And I just decided I was going to use my brain and make decisions for myself. And I did it. So I saw her and I watched her with her friends, and I thought her friends seemed to like her. People come over her and talk to her. People enjoy talking to her. She was, you know, and it wasn't like, "Oh, we got to be with you." Like, people would come over and have conversations with her. And she'd listen to them. I could tell she was listening. And I thought, now there's a novel concept, to have somebody that listens. And I noticed how kind she was to people. And I thought, well, that would be interesting. And so I said, "Well, would you like to have coffee or something?" And she said, "I don't know." But, you know, I do know what the word no means, but I also know that sometimes there's a little wiggle room. And so I bugged her. So the rest is history, kind of. But we spent a year getting to know each other. And she spent time getting to know my son and all of that. And it was like a decision that I made based on the facts. And it hasn't been difficult. The truth of the matter is, we've never even fought. It doesn't happen. I'm in my adult. She has easy time being in her adult. Easier time than I used to. I mean, I'm pretty good at it now. But when we come to the table, we kind of, okay, I'm this age, you're that age, let's stay that age, okay, while we're talking about this. And when you have two functioning adults who can go out in the world, and she's a cop and I'm a therapist, and we help other people manage their lives, right? We can at least do that for ourselves. So when we come to the table, it's like, this is what matters to me, this is what happens for me, this is how I feel about this, and then I said, this is what, but okay, well, what do you think would be the best option? Well, what would you like, what would you like, and here's what I'd like, and blah, 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 and we're done. I don't miss the drama. Now, at first I kind of wondered, well, if there's no drama, is there real feelings? Now, that went away pretty fast because I knew that wasn't true in my head, but I got to know about the truth of it. And the other one is that I finally just had to walk away.
Like, how did you do that?
I said, I'm walking away now. And I got that, you're a bad person, you're a mean person, you're a bitch, you're horrible, you're mean. And your anger, because I used to say, you know, I'm angry about that, and I'm angry about that, and I'm angry. And your anger is overwhelming, and you're this, and you're that, and I thought, you know, I really got to have some boundaries around this. Because none of that's about me. I'm in a program that says that when I screw up, I got to make amends right away. And so I do that in my relationships. I say, okay, I've screwed up. I need to make amends. I'm going to try and do it differently later. And I've always done that. So I was trying to keep my side of the street clean. But it wasn't, and I mean, and it was hard to leave because it sounded so good. You know what it's like. People say all the things that they think you want to hear. Talk all that stuff. It's really hard. Get out of that. Your ears are ringing. You know, and you know what? Sounded just like my parents. Just like them. I mean, you, bad. It's all your fault. Everything here is all your fault. Bad, bad, bad. And, you know, I'm an addict, so what I did what most addicts do. Well, I just got to be more perfect. I just got to do this better. I'll do better, 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 better. And then finally, one day, it'll be enough. Now, I knew those words. They were ringing in my ears. And when I finally realized that, oh, this has about the same potential as having Thanksgiving dinner with my parents and having it go well. That's just not going to work out. And so I left, even though, you know, she didn't want me leaving. There was no question about that. Did not want me leaving. But when I decided to leave, I left. And I did what I think is a good thing. I left her alone. I didn't think, oh, well, we got to be friends and we got to, you know, work this. No, we don't. That just keeps opening up the wounds. You know, you decide to leave, you move your body out of the situation and let them recover themselves. You're not going to be one. And for people who get left, if they're leaving you alone, it's because they care about you. And that doesn't mean that they really want to be with you, but it means now you're going to be free to get yourself well. Yes?
I have two questions, too.
Yes.
Could you compare magical thinking to beliefs and faith? And what do you think about getting into a relationship in the F program?
Well, what is magical thinking and compare that to beliefs and faith?
Yes.
Well, magical thinking is persisting in a belief that has been proven to be false. And that you think that somehow, magically, if you have enough, you know, faith, you pray hard enough or whatever, that this thing will come true. Now, my faith is understanding that I'm not in charge of the universe, including my own. And so, for me to even ask a specific G, would you give me a relationship, is me being in control. I don't know. If I'm turning it over, I'm just showing up every day. And so, you know, I know that miracles happen. My God, the whole room's full of them. And I know that people get into wellness, into recovery, into relationships that are positive. If they're working their program and they know that their higher power is in charge, but they do it because they're living their life, not because they're focusing on who's next and where am I going to find them and, oh, I better go on this website or do that. So when you're doing that, you're taking control. Living your life is the way that you meet people. And then you turn it over. It's like you turn over the outcome. I don't know how this is going to be, but I'm going to go to that softball tournament and make a complete and utter fool of myself, which I did. Total. Everyone's laughing at me. But I still turned over the outcome. I wasn't going there looking for anyone. And I didn't go on hikes looking for anyone. And I didn't go to the movies or the theater looking for anyone. I went to the movies to look at a movie. Went to the theater to see a show. I went on a hike to commune with nature. And I did this to raise money. And I turned the outcome over.
I understand. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And about the S program, I think that it's tricky, and I think there's some rules about it. But I am not the one to determine who's going to be in a relationship with anyone. I had an issue about 13-stepping, I'll tell you right now. When I first got in the program, you would get confronted. That was the only time you'd get confronted in a 12-step meeting back then. Is it if old-timers saw you 12-stepping somebody? They'd be in your face 2 seconds later and say, you can kill that person, knock it off. Mm-hmm. So I had the same attitude about that. Yes?
Thank you very much. This is actually been a really well
added.
It's been a really beneficial talk. I'm in a very long-term married relationship, which was happy, and yet I managed to act out countless times, et cetera, et cetera. And right now, the last 5 months have been the best 5 months of my married life, dating life 10 years before that. most of your talk addresses towards folks who are not in married life stuff. Can you expand upon a little bit some of your feelings about, because this is all great advice if I was single, mm-hmm. and I would love to take some of it. Mm-hmm. I'd like to adapt this into my, I'm already in a relationship, but I'd like to keep getting stronger.
Mm-hmm. Well, this might not be the most popular perspective on this, but I believe that when a person is an addict, and the co-addict or the other addict, I mean, you know, whoever it is that's with them, needs to get in their own program, and it needs to be their own process. And I encourage people who are married or in primary relationships to stay out of one another's recovery process, but they need to be in one. Absolutely. And then, when they come back, you know, and they need to do their codependency work. I mean, she didn't marry you by accident. She's got her own, she zipped right over there to sex addiction, and because she was, you know, found some way that hooked up with her family of origin. So she needs to do her codependency issues, work those. And then when you come back together, it's like you both need to be able to be in your functional adult. And then it works. But I really think that, like, being in each other's program all the time and having her policing you or, you know, any of that, that's crazy making. Totally no boundaries.
We've been really careful, actually, a lot about not working each other's program
Good.
Stuff. But mm-hmm. we're kind of dating each other right now.
That's great.
It's exciting and it's fun, but it's also bizarre and rocky. So I'm just curious if feedback on that.
Well, I think if you are able to, you know, if you've done especially your codependency work, when I say it, when you get into your adult and you come to the table as in your adult reality, that rockiness calms down. So if you notice that it's rocky or there's drama going on, the thing for you to do is to say, how old do I feel right now? You know, which one of me is in here running the show? And if it's not your, if I'm not, if my 40-year-old isn't in charge, I need to get him in charge. And that might be just as simple as saying, what does a 40-year-old man do when his wife is X, Y, and Z, or saying X, Y, and Z? That's, because if you really do try to be in your adult realities at your age, when you're interacting with each other, it really does tend to bring that intensity level down. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would you recommend for someone who wanted to work on their codependence issues, like to find a therapist? Because it's hard to find people who really do that. A lot of therapists don't even do 12-step. They don't know that much about them.
I know, and their lives would be so much easier if there were people going to 12-step. Well, I know that... I'll just tell you, over at the Legacy Center where I live, we have two full-time therapists, and we have two more, well, one more that's going to be coming on full-time but is doing half part-time. I know that, so I know we do it. I think there are people who say they do codependency work, but they don't know what codependency is. They think more in terms of it's dependent, being dependent on somebody. That's not it. And so, you know, what you could do is you could read Pia Melody's book on facing codependence, get your basic understanding about it, and then when you're shopping for a therapist, go and say, have you read this book? I would do that. And what do you know about codependence? And if they say, well, you know, I know that people, when they're codependent on each other, say, well, thank you very much. Because you don't want to be having to train them. The other thing is that you can do, down the Meadows has this, I think Sierra Tucson has it, where they do survivors workshops. That's when you're doing codependency work, you're only working on yourself from 0 to 17. That's all you're doing. Okay? So, then survivors workshop, they have those. I do them up here, they're called legacy workshops. Mm-hmm. And you just work on 0 to 17. And you take all that stuff that creates the codependence, and you deal. You deal. And you get really smart about it, you get your history straight about it, good education about it, and then you have an opportunity to do feelings reduction work about it, and which takes a lot of the energy out of it, and then it's just easier.
Yeah. What's that called? 0 to 17.
0 to 17. That's the work you're doing.
Okay. That's
the. So it's either survivors workshop, and that's at the Meadows or Sierra Tucson, and the legacy workshop is one that I do here. Same thing.
Oh, are you doing some in the future?
I do them on a regular basis.
Oh, will we can come to those? Right?
Anybody can come to those as long as they're not in an active addiction.
Oh.
They can't be actively drinking or actively drugging.
Is it a group setting?
4 or 5 people.
Oh. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, you. Sorry.
First, I want to say thank you because I'll be presenting Clinton and I'm going to be up here this weekend. If I keep this for members and the accidents to a few people, I'm finding out that I really was meant to be here. And the way I've been told by previous service that I have co-dependence, and I always kind of shrugged it off, but the way you explained it today has really opened my eyes to a lot of things. I appreciate that. But I had a question about you mentioned love addict and the love addict side and the avoidance side, and I just would like a little more clarification.
Okay. Yeah. When there's a love addiction going on, there's generally a love addict on one side and avoidant on the other, and they do this dance. And what the love addict does is that the love addict finds this person, right, and they immediately make them into their higher power. And they base whatever thoughts they have about what they think the future holds for them on possibilities, on what ifs, on... I'm looking for the word and I can't find it, but it'll come back to me tonight. So, but they lose focus. Love addicts lose focus of who the person really is, what they're really doing, what they're really saying, and they start deciding that, well, you know, that'll change in the future, or you don't really mean that. When you start to know me more, then you'll change your mind. And so that's all on what might happen in the future. Okay? So they have this person, they put them on this pedestal, they make them a higher power, and they devote all this super intense time, attention, and energy to this person in spite of harmful consequences to themselves or the people in their lives. So, like, if, say, you have children, right, and then you get the next person that's going to be your love addict focus, your focus of your love addiction, and all of a sudden you're not there for your kids, and you can't go to their school things, and, you know, you're not getting up early in the morning because you've been on the phone with this person all night long, and so, you know, there are ways that harmful consequences usually start, and it usually has to do with what's happening in your life, okay? So that's what the love addict does, and they start to adulate this person, like their higher power, you're the most wonderful thing. Well, so then the avoidance over here, that feels good. I like being the higher power. I like somebody adulating me, telling me what a wonderful person I am, and how there's nobody else in the world like me, and they never met anyone like me, and oh, gee, that feels so good. My ego gets stroked, my ego gets stroked, my ego gets stroked. But then after a while, I'm a little sick of this. I don't want to be the center of this person's life. And it starts to feel like, ooh, I got to get out of here, and kind of like I'm in prison. And so then I start to find ways to get out. Like I might have someone else out there that has my attention, or I may like, oh, I got to go to Vegas and do some gambling, or, you know, my work is just taking up so much time, I just can't, so I'm going to go over there and work. I'm going to find a way to get away. So when I start moving away, then the love addict starts clawing and, oh, you got to come back. Oh, God, without you. Don't abandon me. You're abandoning me. Just like everyone else, you've abandoned me. And so now this one's like really out of there. Now here's what happens in the dance, though, and it's a dance. So this one, the avoidant succeeds in getting out. The love addict is totally crushed. Right? But the love avoidant also is love addict. And as soon as this love addict is not paying attention anymore and adulating anymore and trying to get him back, then the avoidant is like, well, wait a minute. Now, don't forget about me. Oh, and this is what, oh, you know that DVD you lent me? I still have it. Here, can I come over and bring it to you? Hook? Okay. Or, you know, we were going to go. I got tickets. When we were still together, I got tickets to go see blah, blah, blah. And I still have those. and a great ticket. Uh-huh. You know, we could probably just go. So even the avoidance, as soon as they're out the door, what Pierre called it, back walking away. Because as soon as they're back, they're also finding a way to get out again. Okay? Because they're in a really powerful position. That's a fact. The avoidant makes the decision about what's going to happen in this relationship until, you know, at some point what happens, maybe, is that the love addict goes, enough of this crap. I'm not doing this anymore. And then when the avoidant comes back, it goes, Hook, hey, what about those tickets to the Mariners game, right? The love addict goes, have a nice time at that Mariners game without me. Then what happens? All of a sudden, this avoidant, gotta have her. Gotta have her. Now, they're in the love addict mode. And the love addict, who was the original love addict, is now a love avoidant. And so now, this one that had all this power over here, doing this back and forth, I'm in charge of who's going to be in this relationship, all of a sudden, gotta have him, no matter what. So then they go back over that way. And then this person, well, because they're the primary love addict. See? They need me. They need to be here. So they turn back around. They're back in their love addict position. What happens to this one? Back in avoidant. You ever seen those relationships or ever been in those relationships? In, out, in, out, in, out, in, out. On again, off again, on. That's what that is.
I get the whole codependent stuff,
yep.
But I can't relate to the love addict / love avoidant thing. Because I've been in a number of relationships, but what I tend to do is just as soon as they get too serious or too intimate, I just run away.
That would be called an avoidant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Basic avoidant. You're one of us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I totally get. I mean, just a very, very quick story. When I was like 20 years old, I moved out of my house. My mom says, "Don't forget to take those two boxes from the basement. They're your stuff." I called them, put them in my new place, didn't look them for a long time. Finally opened them up. It was everything I ever gave her as a small kid. The first letter I pulled out on the top was a little card I wrote for her for like Valentine's Day or Easter or something, and for Mother's Day, Happy Mother's Day. You know, little kid writing. I could not be more than first grade. And I wrote, "I love you," to me, love me. And it was one of the saddest moments in my life. And that just summed up my whole childhood.
That's where your codependency work would come in.
Yeah.
Because whatever's feeding that love avoidant is that codependence.
Yes.
So if you want that energy out of there, you go take care of that.
I absolutely. And William just gave me that what we talked about.
Okay, good.
So I'll be working on that.
Okay. I support you in doing that. Well, you know, they could work on that in therapy. You know, it's like after they do, like, the main work, the survivors or legacy. Because, you know, survivors and legacy, you can do those, that kind of work on an outpatient basis. It's really long. It's arduous. It takes a long time, and a lot of things happen in people's lives. If you just take that week or something and just plow through it, it's really worth it. Then, you know, it's like once you get that out of the way, then if you continue to do the work on building self-esteem, on knowing your reality, on living in moderation, it's like this is something that you just, you know, you pick one or two people. You know, you can do it in therapy, you can do it with a sponsor, where you're trying to create this new reality. And you're not fully, you know, it's like it's not a fake. We really are precious human beings. We really are precious. We were born precious and perfect in our imperfection. We shouldn't have to make excuses for our very existence. That's not right. But we should be able to feel like we belong on this planet, in this race. just like everyone else. And, you know, whenever you're going one up or one down, you're not doing it. So it's like it takes some work to do that. Now, there's no prescription for that, but it takes, you know, it's like I tell people, do this at the Land of Legacy. Do these things. If you keep doing these things, even if you don't feel like it, even if you don't want to, you keep doing it anyway, those things will start to fit into place. It's just, you know, it's some of it's just rote because it's in there. And you start to acknowledge it. You start to accept it. So, that. Okay. Yes?
Everybody sort of comes to life with a map of what they find around and sexually pleasing. Can you relate that at all to the codependent?
Well, first of all, I would take issue with that. That assumption.
What was the question?
He said that people come to life with a basic map of what is erotic to them. And right? Yeah. And I said, and then what was the other part?
And is there a relationship between the codependence issues and that sort of idea one has about?
Yeah. And what I said was I take issue with that assumption. That people come and they have the basic map of what's erotic to them. And what I have noticed, and I know there's a lot of discussion about this in sex therapy circles and in psychology circles, but what I've noticed over the last 35 years is that people arrive with their genitals, you know, and they respond equally to any kind of stimulation when they're babies and when they're little children. But as soon as their brain starts to work, and maybe even before, you know, they're cognitively aware of what's going on, the templates start to be formed. But it's not something that was already there. It's formed.
You're an adult now and you have a template.
You have it used. The templates start to be formed by your sexual experiences early on. So what happens with this work in codependency is if some of those templates were formed as a result of abuse, sexual interruption, and it's not, you know, and by the way, abuse is not necessarily on purpose. Parents don't set out to hurt their kids most of the time. It just happens. And so we don't assign guilt and, you know, we're not going to go to court and sue everybody. It really is about how those templates, for instance, a sexual template, are created in their brain. Because your sexuality is in your brain, not in your gonads. In your brain, and that those templates are formed as a result of your sexual experiences from early childhood on. If there's abuse, what we do in codependency work is we take that abusive situation and, you know, unwind it, because you can almost, by looking at someone's adult sexual template, you could almost follow it right back to where the abuse or the interference occurred. And what we do with that is that we work on the feelings reduction of those experiences so that as you reduce the impact of the feeling reality of those of that experience, the template can change. And I've seen it change. Takes a lot of courage to do that, and, you know, it takes a little time, but they really do change. And, you know, I've seen people with lots of, say, fetishes that are driving them crazy, because they do drive people crazy, and they go back and they do that work and they take that energy out of that where those fetishes happen, and it's not like all of a sudden the fetishes are gone, but the next time they see that thing that they have a fetish about, they just don't have the energy around it. And it's kind of like, where'd all that energy go? Well, we took it out because it really wasn't yours to begin with. Because whenever there's any kind of sexual, you know, sexual templates that involve abuse or interference as a child also has a huge amount of shame wrapped up in it. And some of that feelings reduction work is going to be the shame that didn't belong to the child that they carry around for the adults that did what was that they did. And so, you know, that's why Pat Carnes, when he was actually doing a lot of work with sex addicts, he's not so much anymore, but when he was doing that, But, you know, it's like he get people to stop acting out, and then he'd send them right into survivors or right into legacy. It was like, boom, now you're ready to undo that, because it works out pretty well. Okay. Yes.
Okay, so with the 12-step program, we've got 12 steps, and they cover a lot of stuff. But knowing the 12 steps a little bit, it's not specific to a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to know is, at one point in recovery, or the person in recovery, would it be a good idea to start addressing these issues? And are some of them actually addressed in the steps? Which ones?
Okay. What I suggest to people is that when they stop drinking, for, you know, depending on their, you know, drinking history, how much they have to do to actually get the cobwebs out of their drug history, sometimes it takes about a year for people to start really working on this. And I'm telling you, if you do it too soon, it can really blow up in your face. Bad. With sex, with process addictions, sex, love, gambling, work, you know, those addictions, eating disorders, as soon as you have about 90 days under your belt of not acting out, depending on what it is, all right, you can start doing this work. And, you know, but you need to do it with the knowledge that it's going to rock your boat. It's really going to rock your boat. This is not, this, you know, you're going to feel really bad for, you know, for a while. If you're in survivors, you'll feel really bad for 4 days. And then you'll feel better. But it goes because you're dealing with the core issues that created the addictions in the first place. And so, yeah, it's going to rock your boat. And what I've noticed, and the reason I love 12-step program, aside from the fact that it's a mother, is that almost all addicts, I don't care what your addiction is, have what, the, you know, clinically we call personality disorders, or at least a flavor of a personality disorder. Like every addict that drinks, every alcoholic and drug addict has at least a ribbon of borderline personality disorder, because they're self-destructive, and that's one of the symptoms of borderline personality disorder. And then there are dependent personality and antisocial personality disorders. And there's a whole bunch of personality disorders. Personality happens from about 0 to 6 years old. And undoing that kind of thing in therapy is really arduous work. And I don't mind doing it. I mean, it can be done. But 12-step works so much better. I've actually seen people who are hardcore personality disordered individuals who, when they go in and work a 12-step program exactly the way they're supposed to, with a sponsor and everything, their personality starts to change. And that's good for them, because once their personality starts to change, they become more available to themselves to actually make the changes that they want to make in their life so that they can get what they want out of their life. And so, as a therapist, I love it. It's like, I could deal with the core issues, I could deal with the codependency issues, and I can send them off to get clean, sober, stop their addictive processes, and deal with their personality disorders in 12-step program, where they don't have to pay a lot of money, they go when they need to, meetings all the time, you know, helps them get well or faster. Okay. Yes?
Do you have any advice for someone who's dating someone in a helping profession?
Like, run! No. Just kidding. I was just kidding on that. It is my opinion, and boy, do I have some. You know, I know I'm opinionated. It is my opinion that every person in a helping profession needs to be in codependency recovery. We are professional codependents. We do it professionally. And if we are not in recovery, I wouldn't be in a relationship with a therapist or someone in the helping profession who wasn't in recovery. That's my opinion. And that's my advice. And, you know, you could tell them, say, hey, you know, you can go to Al-Anon, you can go to CODA. There are some CODA meetings around now that I understand are actually turning out pretty good. And those are good places to start. and give them the book. Read this book. Yes.
I've been in recovery for since December,
mm-hmm.
and I started getting sober, and soon after that I felt that I didn't really need to be in recovery. There's the whole voice of denial that keeps coming up every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to throw that out there and ask you, how does one deal with that voice of denial?
If they find out they don't need to be in recovery?
Yeah, I feel like I don't really need to be, like I'm fixed.
Uh-huh. You're the first person I ever met that graduated. No, it's a way of life, and so it's a way of life. So it's really not about I'm fixed now, because there is no fixing. It's about getting better, weller, doing it differently. And I always think that if nothing else, Al-Anon is just a good place to stay stable, even if you don't want to be in the other 12-step programs. Yes, sir.
Say you're feeling healthy enough to be in a relationship, and you meet somebody that you feel is pretty healthy in their life, and then you tell them your history, that you have a history of sex addiction, and you're involved in recovery work and that type of thing. And the other person feels that they're healthy enough in their life that they don't need recovery to be in recovery for anything. But yet, you as an addict, you always have that hanging over you, the fact that, you might act out and all that, and if you do act out, how's that other person going to deal with that in the relationship? So
here's where the magic power of boundaries comes in. So if you're self-contained, I talk to people who I work with who are sex addicts a lot about how much they divulge about their addiction to anybody, because people don't get it, they don't understand. And when you tell them you're in recovery for a sex addiction, they're kind of freaked out by it, and they really should be happy about it, but they're not. And so, I like to make sure that a person's boundaries are intact when they're going to do that, meaning that they're making good decisions about what information you give. Because you can't decide what they're going to do. That's in the 90 days where you're determining whether or not. It's like, if I need someone to be in a 12-step program so that we can have that kind of interaction, is this going to work for me or not? Not about how can I get her to do it, or how can I encourage her to do it, or how can I see her, what a great idea this would be to do it. Is it, is she doing it? Is she not doing it? How does that affect me? So I guess there's two things there. And if she's healthy, like you said, she's healthy, then if she hears that you're in recovery, she might want to know more about what that is so she just understands what it is. If she doesn't have any issues with it, then, if she doesn't have her own stuff going on, then she's going to hear that and say, she's acting her age, not in a state of codependence. Wow, I got someone who has a clue about themselves. How unusual. I think this is a good thing. If you've triggered them, now they're going to get all over the board with you. Then you say, you know what? I talk about my sex addiction. She gets all triggered, goes all over the board. Is this something I can deal with? This is something I want to deal with. Because there will be others out there. This doesn't have to be the one. So, you might need to have a couple of what I call training relationships to find out what it's like to be in a relationship as a recovering person, to know what kind of boundaries to have. It's like I tell my partner, I am a recovering alcoholic. I didn't tell her my story. She still doesn't know my story. That's for me and my program, not for me and my relationship. And so it's like, okay, well, she's a recovering alcoholic. Well, then she does whatever she does with it. It's not my business. See what I mean? That's what boundaries do for you. And you just get to know who I'm with and what she's capable of doing.
We just have time for
one more question. Okay, one more question. Yes, sir.
Okay, I had two questions.
Okay, sorry, you can only answer last one.
Real quickly, you made a distinction between folks who have poly addictions, you know, more than one addiction, and then you referred to those of us that have a love addiction, and that's the only addiction. But you didn't say sex addiction, and one question was, so do you see sex addiction or lust addiction as being just one of those other addictions you have to work to before you get to love addiction? And then number two, you also...
Can I answer that one first?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Sneak it in, though.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Most love addicts have what looks like a sex addiction when they're in the midst of their love addiction. Because what love addicts do is that they hook them with sex. And so they're not like out looking for sex, and they're not looking for the high that sex gives them. They're looking for that, now I've had sex with you, I own you. So it's more of a process of their love addiction. And I separate that out from sex addiction, which is a whole group of behaviors that people do obsessively, compulsively, in spite of harmful consequences that they can't control.
Okay, that's great, because that makes that clarify. Mm-hmm. And therefore I don't think I'm a love addict.
Mm-hmm.
The other question I had was, you said that, I'm not sure if I got this right, anyone who in their childhood has been experienced being abandoned, abused, or neglected, chances are you're probably going to be a love addict? And the reason I ask that is because as a sex addict,
uh-huh,
and being in a household where my wife is codependent but in denial about it, my children have been to some degree and at some time abandoned, abused, and neglected. And so I wonder, you know, is that definite for them, that outcome, you know?
What I've noticed, and this is just one of those higher power things, is that when parents get in recovery for their addictions, and if both of them get grand, but if one, at least one of them gets in recovery for their addictions and stays in recovery for their addiction, there's this thing called grace that starts to happen for the kids.
I've been seeing that.
Yeah, it's really weird. It's like all of a sudden they start acting different, they start feeling better. They're not busy trying to distract themselves all the time. They just have a better option at it, and I just call it grace, because I have no idea what that is except that.
Okay.
Okay. So that's all for today.